kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
I'm pretty sure if he ever heard had to say my name, he wouldn't go, is it Pernell or Pernell? Pernell? Like, whatever, he's going to say what he thinks it is and go with it.
Pioniel. Pioniel.
Pioniel.
Pioniel.
And I've actually had people mispronounce my name or misspelled. I'll just say close enough.
And the last name is Veojahan.
I like that better than my name, actually. Yes.
Pioniel Veojahan.
Yes, I'm. I feel and you're more Swedish. Than ever. I'm Swedish now. Shit.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. No guests today, except I have a bunch of guests, because this is going to be a review-heavy episode. We've had a big backup going on for a while, and it just seems perfect that everybody's ready to go at the same time. So this episode is going to be a review, followed by more reviews, and then more reviews, and tons of guests on the way. And I'm going to kick things off with one of our favorite recurring guests and reviewers, Pernell Vaughn. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Currently trying to see how many ink pens I can have hang off of my hair at once. It's an interesting game.
I wish I had hair.
Oh, I do too. That's where the game comes in. It's like, there's a piece I think sticking out there. That's close enough. Use some alligator clips to attach. You know, do with what you got.
Are you excited to be the leadoff for this review episode?
Well, yeah. I mean, I shaved my face and put on some cologne. I went all in on this, man. I was ready.
Nice. So let us get things started. We're going to kick things off with the game Race the Sun, developed and published by Flipfly. It released April 21st on Xbox One for $9.99. You are a solar craft. The sun is your death timer. Hurtle towards the sunset at breakneck speed in a futile race against time. Delay the inevitable by catching energy boosts, which reverse the setting sun, if only for a moment. Pernell, tell me about this game.
This game is actually pretty cool. To my understanding, this is I guess what you'd consider an endless runner style game, where you are pretty much constantly going towards the screen in pursuit of this sun. And as you start off the game, it's just like, here you go, start dashing, and your solar craft is, you know, jetting forward, sun is setting, and as you get to, like, if you say fly behind like a mountain pass or something, you start to slow down because you're not getting solar power anymore. So you have to stay away from tall structures and you have to just keep jutting forward and collecting little like triangular power ups to boost your score booster. Because I guess in the style of the way this endless runner scores you is you get points just by staying moving, continuing to move. And every time you find five of these triangular pickups, it increases the multiplier on how your score is constantly being generated. So you're constantly picking up triangles, avoiding tall obstacles that block the sun, and just basically just dashing. And the game is freaking hard.
Yeah, it looks difficult. The videos I've seen of it, because I haven't had a chance to pick it up myself yet, but the videos I see, it does not look like an easy game.
It's not. I almost feel ashamed to be reviewing it only because I played a good amount of it because I liked the game, but I never got past Region 2. It's like, smash, smash. Like, God damn it. Now, I think the way I gathered is that the game doesn't just constantly, it's not a constant, you know, reimaging of the map. It takes time. So you'll get a world build, I guess you would call it. And you get a period of time to play with it because there are, you know, perfect runs you can do that you have to learn what route is perfect for getting the most power up boostings and the most, you know, multipliers added to your score. So you do that. And after a certain amount of time, I say, like, I guess it's maybe a couple hours at a time, it'll redo the world for you. You have to start to relearn it again. I haven't even kept track so much of the leaderboards and stuff because my concern was just not dying on Region 2, which I fail exponentially yet, but that was my goal, so I focused on that. And I'm not sure how much more happens with the game, but I do like that they have a level up system based around goals. So one example might be collect 25 triangles in one session, or get through two regions without dying or taking damage.
It's a lot like an endless runner, a lot like a Jetpack Joyride or Temple Run, stuff like that.
Yeah, I didn't know those games had like goals in the middle of them, but if they do, then yeah, definitely. Because every time you get a certain number of goals, you level up, and the level up will introduce something new to the world. Like you might get a new power up, or you might get a sun extending item that'll allow the sun to stay out longer, stuff like that. So it ultimately changes the way the game gets played. So I like the fact that it's designed in a way that it wants you to play the game in its current form, get decent at it. And as you get decent and good at it, they introduce something new to the game that allows you to go further and do better, or outright just change the game entirely, which requires you to kind of learn it in a little bit of a different manner. So
nice.
And the only thing I don't like about it, this is a preference thing I wish they did. I wish you could turn left and right with the trigger. And for all I know, maybe you can. I just didn't check the controls. But you can go. You basically go. You steer left to right with the cross pad. But for some reason, I would like to be able to do it with the triggers. Because I mean, if you're thinking about it and you're like trying to do like gentle nudges and stuff like that, it works out. It would work out better. You know, tap, 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 tap. Though, of course, I can imagine why they didn't do that. Because even in regards to if you were flying a ship, ships aren't steered with buttons or steered with a controller. So, and you would turn left and right, not tap a button to go left and right.
True.
So, I can see why they didn't do that, but I was like, man, it'd be nice if I could just like tap adjust, do slight adjustments. There are other ships. I didn't bother with those because what happened was it was like, choose your ship. And I'm like, okay. And I'm going left and right. And I didn't notice anything outright telling you at the time, this is what makes this ship better than that ship. So I was like, well, if it's not telling me what the difference, I'm just going to stick with the one I got. I just like using this one. So that's good all stuff. I did. But I like the game. It was a solid play.
Overall, for $10, what do you think?
I think it's a definite buy, especially if you can convince a friend to buy it with you so you can compare how well you did against each other.
Yeah, I definitely plan on picking this one up soon, though.
It's a good one. Definitely appreciate it. I'm not sure if it actually got any... I mean, I feel like I've seen or heard about it, but I think it had... Did it get buzz leading up to the game's release, or was it just kind of a surprise drop?
I really don't know. I just see it pop up, and I send out requests, and I think it was that on other platforms earlier. Let me look this up, because I am prepared, clearly. Yeah, it looks like it released in 2014 on PlayStation 4, so it's been out for a decent amount.
Okay, so it's new to the third Xbox One.
Yeah, and they the PlayStation version added VR support.
Oh, wow, that's pretty good. So this game, I don't think I'd want to play this with VR, though. That's a lot of motion sickness. And just possibly PTSD for the wrong person, so... Probably not. I just keep seeing images of crashing vessels, exploding vessels.
The nightmares.
the sun, it won't stop attempting to set. That's what the real sun does, too. Stop telling me these things. It's just a challenge right there. But, yeah, I definitely say it's worth the $10. I had a lot of fun playing that game, and I do intend to play more of it. It's a good pickup and play, too.
Nice. Sounds good. Next game to chat about is called Flint Hook. This one is developed and published by Tribute Games. It released April 18th on Xbox One, PS4, and Steam for $14.99. Live the life of Space Captain Flint Hook. Armed with your mighty hookshot, your uncanny slow motion powers, and your trusty plasma pistol, plunder and fight your way through an infinite variety of randomly assembled spaceships for treasure, loot, and fame. Pernell, what about this one?
This game. Okay. I've played other games that Tribute has done. Most specifically, I'm sure you may have heard of it, was a game called Mercenary Kings. It came out a few years ago and it was kickstarted. A lot of hype went into it because it had Paul Roberson doing the artwork and it just looked so cool and it was like a sort of Metal Slug type game. And then when I bought it and played it, it left me underwhelmed. It had issues. The enemy variety was kind of lacking. I didn't mind the music, though. It was a very grind-heavy, in an unfun way, sort of game. And the enemy variety was poor. It's almost like someone else felt that way too, and they were much louder and bitchier about it because Flynn Hook fixed all of those things. Nice. This game is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had no idea this was the same team behind Mercenary Kings, and they made Wizorb too, and I fucking love Wizorb.
Yeah, Wizorb is awesome. And that was another case of game that you did not expect to be good, but whew, did it get you? Yeah, but this game, like it's as you know already, it's a sort of roguelike style game in the sense of, I don't feel like I want to call it roguelike, but I'll go with it just because it's easy to you know. It's a roguelike style game where you go from like you start out the game and you do the tutorial and it's like here's how to play the game and you're going around, you can grapple. There's like every room always has like a series of hooks in it. You use the hooks to use your grapple shot to grab on and pull yourself, and you also can use that same directions but with a different button to aim your gun and shoot your plasma pistol. So you control yourself and get through this tutorial. You learn how to use the hook shot. You learn how to use your gun. You learn how to use the slow-mo belt. And then at the end, you find a wanted poster, which is pretty much the first boss of the game. And what this does is it gives you your first true level that you can play. So once you select that stage, you get a series of ships to choose from. Each ship is randomly generated, and each one has a series of modifiers on it, which they tell you about at the bottom of the screen, which will be things like labyrinthine, which means it's like very large maze, or it'll say, I can't remember the name of it, but it was like spike heavy or something, which means that there's like spikes all over. There's a lot of areas of the ship that have protruding spikes. Mm. And there's a ridiculous array of modifiers on these ships. It's kind of cool. And then once you've done that, it lets you set up a series of perks, which are modifiers for your character that you can unlock by purchasing them on ships or from a later unlockable black market, which you can use. You can buy stuff using gems, either what you find in the main game or from the weekly daily challenge, which I'll bring up a little bit later. So you unlock these perks, you use them, you enter the ship that you use, you plunder through the ship until you get to the end of the level, which will provide you with a specific gem. And after you get the gem, you leave the ship, ship goes boom, and you choose another ship. And once you get a certain number of these completed, the thing that you're feeding them to is like a ghost compass or some weird thing. Once you fed it enough of the gems you get from beating ships, it will unlock the destination to the actual boss of the level. And then you can go take on the boss and hopefully not get your ass kicked.
Hopefully.
Because the game is actually not easy either. It's challenging. Like, in a good way, though. It's not stupid challenging. Though I'll admit, a part of me I'm not going to be able to give an accurate depiction of the challenge, as I should, for one reason. And that is because I spent more time than I should have on the daily and weekly challenges. I enjoyed them. What they are is, as you could expect, a level that is created that's done one on a daily basis and one is on a weekly basis. And it usually has certain things on it. I'm guessing this might be a regular thing. Like, for example, something called a relic shot, which is something which you can use by you collect enough money on the ship. And then you take it to this relic shop, which is also on the ship, and you can buy this item, which does, to my knowledge right now, nothing but function as a collectible in the game. But if you're a grab-all kind of guy, well, that's kind of important. So you're going to do that. So you'll be doing that a lot, but these levels are really, really hard. the enemy variety is really good. Like, there's a ton of different monsters that show up, so you don't really get bored of the types of obstacles and enemies you see. They give you plenty. And you will get your ass kicked. But as you go, you explore these ships, you find money to buy items on the ship. You'll find sub items, which you can have one time use, like a bomb that you can throw that explodes. There's like a skull that will release three skulls in a circular outward pattern that can hurt dudes. And there's like, I found like a snow globe, which you throw and it freezes time for a couple of seconds of all the enemies in the room. So there's a lot of cool stuff that's going on in this game. And funny enough, also, when I first booted it up, they gave you a depiction of here's all the controls you can input. And it felt overwhelming at first, but I was wrong. Once you start playing the tutorial stage and they kind of introduce you to each individual mechanic, it becomes a second nature sort of thing. And eventually you're going to be grappling and snappling and tackling like the best of them in a good way. Also, the music is spectacular and the artwork is pretty funny. The intro cartoon actually brought a smile to my face, I got to admit.
That's a great looking game too.
Oh, it is. It's just small touches. Like when you first unlock the black market, they give you an item for free, which allows you to stand in place and aim your gun, because at first you can't even do that. But when you do it in the game, you press the button to go still. The main character's face kind of squints like he's concentrating. And then you can start aiming. And there was just something kind of cool about that. It was just like, that's your indicator that you are standing still, is he gets that concentration face going on. It's a gem. Like, I like it. I was at a friend's house yesterday. We were playing Enter the Gungeon together. And the whole time I was like, I wish he came to my house, because we could have been playing freaking Flint Hook right now. I don't know why, damn it. But
you're going to have more game nights. We're just hooking you up with all the games for game nights.
Works for me. Shoot, keep giving me games. I'll invite people over to play them. I got to dig them up, because my friends are too interested in drinking than playing games while drinking. But hey, that's their loss. I got other friends that like playing games. Let's dig them out of the woodwork. We'll get a game.
Anyway, for $15, what do you think of this one?
I think it's worth the money. It's a solid game. And if you catch it early enough, you might still be able to get on that PS Plus bill, so do it.
Maybe.
But yeah, it's worth it. Xbox, don't they do the discount deal too? Like, that first week or so, you might get
I think it has 10% off everywhere for like the next day, if that, depends on, you know, what time you hear this episode.
Well, when you hear this episode, get on that network and make that buy ASAP, because you don't want to miss out on that discount. It's a small discount, but if you're going to get the game anyway, right?
Might as well save that buck 50, right?
Exactly. I'm going to get some fries, maybe a drink, maybe a can of Monster for more Flint Hook time. It's worth it.
Oh, man. Anyway, before we get to your third game, I figure since we're talking about a retro-styled game and we're about to talk about another retro-styled game, I might as well get you involved in this, since I've had you involved in almost all of them. But we have two more Arcade Archive Neo Geo games to talk about. Are you down for chatting about those?
Sure. They are really barreling those out, aren't they?
There's one, at least one every week. And I love it, because I'm a fan of the series. A lot of people complain about, it's $8 for a 30-year-old game, a 20, 30-year-old game. But they're fucking, it's better than $300.
Yeah, and at the same time, no one's forcing them to buy it. And if they don't want to pay $8, $9, give it time. It'll go on sale. The important part is that it's being made available.
Yeah.
Period. You can buy it when it hits your price point.
They shouldn't even bother releasing these. Why?
People need to shut up. There you go.
Because it's too expensive, and they're not good, and they have glitches, and I don't like retro games. Okay, you don't like them. Well, there's people out there who do.
Yeah, if their statement is flat out, I don't like retro games, and they don't even have a leg in the race.
Yeah.
Like, that means they don't even care about SNK, because SNK at this point is all retro games. So
all retro, all the time.
Yeah, so if they don't like retro games, why are they commenting on the topic? It's not the companies making new games, so exactly. Shut up.
But the first of the two this week to talk about is called Neo Geo Over Top. I thought at first it was Over the Top, but it's just Over Top. Weird.
Yep, no basketball game, no circus clown game, nothing. It's just something about tops.
It's not Big Top, it's Over Top. So, console version developed and published by Hamster. It released April 20th on Xbox One for $7.99. I believe it also came out on PS4 the same week. I try not to mention other platforms when we're covering these, because their release schedule is so weird depending on what games are coming out on what platforms. Anyway, Over Top is a racing game released by SNK in 1996. Players will participate in a breathtaking races through urban areas, mountainous regions, and snowy roads. The courses also feature weather variations to add more variety to the game. In addition to the various vehicles with different performance factors, which players can use, they can also enjoy the thrill of drifting their way through corners to clear courses. This has a lot in common with like Outrun, where it's basically you start a race and as you complete checkpoints, it gives you a time extension. And there is an ending to this one. It's not an unlimited racer. There is a large area, like a big circuit that you go through. It's like 6 or 7 stages that you can get through. And you got to try to get to the finish, or at least get as far as you can. Controls, it is top down, very similar to like the Micro Machines games or RC Pro-Am, stuff like that. and it's tank.
Oh, it's top down.
Yeah, it's more isometric, but it is like top down above you, and it's tank style controls. So no matter what direction you're facing, if you hit left, you're turning left. If you hit right, you're turning right. Which if you run into a wall and you have to reverse, that could mess you up easily. So the solution is get good, scrub. There are a handful of different vehicles that you could pick through the game. I basically just kind of stuck with the default, and then there was another similar one because each vehicle is graded on like asphalt driving, dirt driving, snow driving, and fuck, there's one more. I forget. It has four different points that it's graded on. And I like to stick with ones that are all purpose and good on everything, because if you pick the one that's great on asphalt but sucks on snow, as soon as you hit that snowy area, you know you're going to spin out like crazy.
So. I'm like that too, but also in some respects it's like I typically want to stick with the default car because that's the one I've gotten the most used to.
True.
So then when they start saying, oh, well, now this car can do this, like, well, I don't want to know different. I want to know what I got. This car should be able to do everything in some way, shape, or form. So
yeah,
work with it.
There's not much in the way of depth with this one. It's very much you pick a vehicle, you start the race, you get as far as you can, or you complete it, and that's it. It's very much an arcade game that's meant to pop in a quarter or 50 cents or whatever, do your race, and then move on to another game.
So it sounds like this is an example of one of their games where it may not be in the game's longevity's best interest for you to do an infinite pop of quarters just to get to the end, because then once you do, then that's the game.
It's not even like if you run out of... Actually, I don't know what happens if you run out of quarters, because when I would play, I would either beat it or I was playing the caravan mode or the high score mode that you only get one credit. So I'm not sure.
So you were able to get to the end on the one?
Yeah, on the standard version, I was able to get to the end. On the high score mode, I've gotten so friggin' close to the end, but I'm just barely missing it. Achievement hunters are probably going to like this one because it is fairly easy to get all the achievements. The only two I'm having trouble with are the one to get checkpoint 6 on caravan mode, which is the you have 5 minutes to get so far in the game, mainly because the achievement doesn't pop when you hit the checkpoint. It's when you start the next area. So strange. I would hit the checkpoint and you're in a tunnel going from area to area, and the timer for the game stops because you're in between, but the caravan timer, because you just have 5 minutes total, that still runs. So you could hit that checkpoint and the 5 minutes could run up before you start the next area and it wouldn't pop. I eventually got it. Just takes practice. High score mode, you have to just beat the game on standard difficulty. And I'm so friggin' close.
So would that caravan mode be an example of a time where choosing the right car may be in the best interest? Because since you're giving you a very finite amount of time, it'll be, okay, well, this car can go faster on this form of, you know, ground material, and the majority of the track up to this point is made of this material, so I should use this car.
And not necessarily, because they change the material so much between the first couple of stages. Like, the first one is all city driving. The second one is more like mountainous. The third one is like back to city. The fourth one is like desert racing. There's snow mixed in there somewhere. Some of them have rain show up. So they do keep you on your toes about the surfaces you'll be driving on.
And the ecosystem in that world is completely out of whack.
Anyway, for $8, I think this one's worth a try. I hope, like, this is one of the games that makes me worry about the refund policy that Microsoft is beta testing, because I worry that people are going to drop the $8 for this, get the achievements, and then before their 2 hours is up, just refund it. And that's such a shitty thing to do.
Yeah, but at that point, that's when it has to become a question, too, of... Yeah, they'll have to definitely evaluate, because someone's scruples are so low that they want to return just because they max out the achievements.
Yeah.
Actually, that should be part of it. Like, maybe them running the game where they can remove the game from your history, which would kill their achievements, which would maybe make them less inclined to return it with that in mind.
Nah, I don't know. This is something we've discussed on the show before. Like, how are they going to police this system to make sure people don't abuse it with games like this? Because another game that is going to be very easy to abuse for achievement points is the other game that released, Fatal Fury 2. Console version developed and published by Hamster, released April 20th on Xbox for $7.99. Fatal Fury 2 is a fighting game released by SNK in 1992. Oh my god, that is so long ago.
Those were the days.
It is 25 years ago. Oh my god, I'm so old.
My back! Oh, somebody!
Terry, Andy, Joe return from the previous installment along with five new fighters in order to decide who is the strongest one. In addition to desperation moves, which can change the outcome of the battle, the two-lane plane mechanic is back and stronger than ever, allowing players to fight each other in stage backgrounds. Just like
remember
all...
the days when... like, remember the days when eight-man cast was a sufficient roster for a fighting game?
Back in the 90s, that was huge. I could pick eight different people, because the first one, you could only pick the three different ones, and you would fight a handful of others. This time,
that's why
you could pick any of them.
That's why I decided to fight. It's like, now with an additional five people, it's like, wow, we haven't even hit single digits yet. This is amazing. Holy.
I will say... many of the Neo Geo fighting games, the one-on-one fighting games, have had difficulty issues. I'm happy to say this one is not brutally difficult. It clearly on harder difficulties, it's harder to get further through the game, but this one is a lot more player-friendly earlier stages when you don't have it, you know, on the most ridiculous difficulties. On the caravan or high score mode, you can actually beat a couple of guys before the computer starts kicking your ass, so that is a very good thing. Otherwise, it's just more of Fatal Fury. It's one-on-one fighting. You have the front plane and the back plane. This time you could actually choose when to jump back between the two, so it gives you more options to be I guess strategic in how you want to attack people. If someone's coming at you, just jump to the back plane and then make them follow you over and then unload on them. Achievements in this one. I got 1,000 achievement points in this one in about 25 minutes.
Are you serious?
Yep.
It feels like games like that maybe shouldn't have a 1,000 achievement deal going for it.
See, that's the beauty of achievements, is that every game is a game now. They don't split them up between arcade and full retail and whatever else. Every game is a game, and it gets 1,000 points. And even with the Arcade Archives ones, just because they follow the same formula, some of them are going to be easy to 1,000, and then others aren't. So many of the fighting games aren't. This one, it's much more doable. Could they have bumped up the point thresholds for some of the achievements? Probably. But, hey, what are you going to do?
I think that's partly why with me, when it comes to achievements and trophies, I delineated less from the total and just focused on the game that they're being acquired in, because if a guy is getting 1,000 points in the game where it's like, punch a guy twice and then smile about it, like, well, that isn't worth crap. Well, but if you look at the total numbers, they can have tons of achievements like that. They'll have this stupid high number, but it's all based on, I guess what my friend used to call them, is mook achievements. It's like, well, if that's how you got your points, that makes your points kind of pointless to me. You know? I'm going to evaluate you on specific games. Is that how you do it too? Like, maybe you'll go say, hey, I'm playing this game, I wonder what achievements this guy got. And you'll go and check, and it's like, oh, I see, he didn't get much of anything here. Huh. But his score is like 4. I guess now at this point in time, the high numbers are like 400,000, 500,000 numbers. He's got such a high score. Let me check out some of my moot games, see what he did. There they are. There are the points. Hey, this guy's nothing.
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that games will release on PlayStation and Xbox, and they're, you know, on PlayStation you can only have so many achievements or so many trophies that you can unlock with X amount of value. So a lot of games will release over there and they can only have like a maximum of 12. So
that's
just
really
do
what
that.
It is a box?
Stuff like that, yeah. You're...
I didn't know the Xbox. I knew about the Xbox because everybody, a lot of people I know talked about what their threshold was, and it was also a point of contention when they had, like you said earlier, back in the day, they had the different totals between if it was an Xbox Live game or not.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody really talked about PlayStation's threshold. It was just, here's some trophies.
You might have a platform. They have a hidden value. I believe it needs to be $15 or more to qualify for a platinum. And depending on the value of the game, you're allotted a hidden total that you're able to get, and they split that up between gold, silver, and bronze. So if you see a game that has a lot of trophies, you'll probably see a lot of bronze, and then there's some that have like six trophies and they're all gold.
Never knew that, but now I'm going to start paying more attention. Yeah, I'm paying more attention to that now. Sometimes.
So even like these Arcade Archives games on PlayStation, when the series first started, they had, I want to say, like 6 or 8 achievements total. And with Xbox, I think it's a minimum of 10. So
they, how did they get past it on there?
They added more achievements.
Oh, that's not bad.
Every game on Xbox in the Arcade Archive series has, I believe, 12. And they're every time it's like, hit this many points, this many points, this many points in standard. The same. They have the three different thresholds for high score and caravan mode, and then there's one for submitting a high score on high score mode, and then one for submitting it and just having a record on standard. So that's your 12. And they're the same across everything. They just have different values.
I never knew it, but like I said, now I'm going to start paying a lot more attention to it because I'm going to see if I can actually spot it in certain places.
But anyway,
especially on a game where I may have on both systems.
Anyway, Fatal Fury 2, it's another fun 2D fighter. The computer isn't ridiculously difficult in this one. I think this one's worth a try it. So both of them this week, I think, are try it's.
Okay.
And then we will get to your final game, Captain Kaon, developed and published by Engage Pixel. It released April 14th on Steam for $6.99. Captain Kaon is a retro twin-stick gravity shooter inspired by 1980s classics such as Thrust and Gravatar. Captain Kaon posts vibrant Amiga-style pixel art with a tight twin-stick control mechanic. Relive this forgotten shmup subgenre. What do you think of Captain Kaon?
Well, based on what you just said about the description, because one thing about these games is, like, once you give them to me, I tend to forget the flavor text lead-in. I'm just like, hey, here's a game. I'll play it. And now that I know that was definitely meant to be Amiga-styled and whatnot, it says a lot for the game as a whole. This game is not easy. It's really, really not. They give you ways out, but there's also, like, when you beat stages, there's, like, a gold medal, silver medal, and bronze medal time achievement for each one, and I will never hit any of those ever in my life. As it said earlier, it's a twin stick shooter, but whereas most twin stick shooters in the present day are one stick to move, one stick to shoot, this game is one stick to aim the nose of your ship and one stick to shoot. And that is a very important thing to lay out because there's an acceleration / propulsion button. And when you're in a scenario where you are in a frantic shootout and you're trying to get out of harm's way, the last thing you're thinking about is, okay, the nose is pointing in this direction, so now I should use the propulsion button to, no, you're like, you want to push up to go up and down to go down, not the propulsion. So there's been more to the few times where I panicked and just like spun into a wall because it's just what I do. But this game is designed in a way where the levels are designed for you to start off. You usually start off on a base and they give you a series of objectives. Like it may say carry fuel from here to there or rescue X number of ships or shoot down these number of guys or even just get to a certain point. And as you fly, you have to, again, guide your ship, propel it. Sometimes you have to actually collect items on the ground using a grapple item and then carry it to a standing checkpoint spot, which is also easier said than done because the objects you have to pick up are about as fragile as shit. So
is shit fragile, though?
I don't know. I mean, the way doctors may handle it, I think it has to be pretty fragile. But basically, like, yeah, it's very fragile. Like, you'll basically like, crash into two walls, and boom, your cargo is just destroyed. And sometimes the cargo has either a purpose of party being part of your mission, or other times they will give you additional supplies. And supplies are an interesting mechanic in this game, too, because when you enter a stage, it's not just a matter of, I want to do the stage, I'm going to play it. No. Every time you do a stage, there is a supply reward, which goes to, they call it resources. I can't remember the exact name, but every time you beat a stage, you get a certain number of resources, and every stage entry requires a certain number of resources to enter. You can replay old stages without resources if you need to farm for more, but you have to actually earn resources to unlock new stages. And an interesting component to this game is sometimes, let's say, for example, there's a stage that you want to do, but the stage is kicking the bejesus out of you. You just don't want to do it, or you're just running out of time. You want to just progress and expand further into the map. You can expend an additional number of resources than what it would cost you to do the stage proper, and they'll just automatically clear the stage for you. So you can say, screw this level. I hate escort missions. I'm going to use my resources here. And it'll just beat the stage for you, so you're not stuck dealing with it. So I kind of like that aspect of it, though. You can overspend and find yourself in a bit of a bind being without resources to do the next stage, which I have done. But it's honestly, if you go into this game with the intent of what you said, which is the, you know, it's based off an Amiga game, or some graphic style game, so you know what it's going to look like when you boot it up. You know there's not going to be a bunch of voiceover work. I think it could be a very much appreciated game because I was enjoying it. I just sucked balls at it. And also, I hope this changes later. I just didn't notice it or something, but the music, there's one track that plays on every stage, which is a very quick, repetitive track. It's not a bad-sounding track, but it makes you yearn for variety.
Mm.
So I'd go with a try it on it because of how difficult it is to play. But if it's a game that could be adjusted to. And I will admit they also do give you a fair number of checkpoints in the stages too. So if you need to blitz through a section and you want to dock your ship to get your health back, you can do that in certain ways. So it's not like it's a completely unplayable game as far as challenge goes. There's ways around it.
Yeah.
So but try it in the sense of, like, you know, dealing with the control schema and just the graphical style. Not a definite buy.
Now, last question. Because of the price of this only being $6.99, do you think that's a cheap enough price to call this one a fuck it, why not? Or
category. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. On cheaper games, it depends, because, you know, sometimes that $7 may still seem like a lot based on how much content is in the game, but then other times it'd be like, there's a lot of stuff in this game. Might not be for everyone, but fuck it, it's only $7.
Yeah, I think for this game it could be that way, because with the style of game that it is, if you already know, like if you already read the description and go, oh, Amiga stuff, I remember games like those games they just named, then yeah, buy the game, and it's going to take you at least an hour to learn, know for sure if you can even handle the controls, because yeah, you might start out sucking at it, but then you'll either get better or you'll just say, I've been playing for an hour, I just can't do this, you know, but by that point, you've been playing for an hour. I mean, at that point, you were still technically entertained. Whether you enjoyed the entertainment is another story entirely, but you were entertained for an hour. And for an hour of entertainment, I think you can do fine for $7 in the game that you had a curiosity for.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Pernell, thank you so much for doing these reviews. Do you have any final words to sum up everything?
You better have bought Crawl.
Next up is the Banner Saga Complete Pack, developed by Stoic, published by Versus Evil, available on PS4 and Xbox One for $37.99, includes both games, as well as the Survival Mode DLC for Banner Saga 2. Live through an epic role-playing Viking saga where your strategic choices directly affect your personal journey. Lead your caravan across the stunning yet harsh landscape as you fight for survival. Every decision you make in travel, conversation, and combat has a meaningful effect. Not everyone will survive, but they will be remembered. Got our good friend Henry Jones on the case for this one. Henry, how you doing today?
I'm all right. I'm just going through wedding stuff. It's a lot of things. A lot more than you think it is.
Oh, Henry, you're growing up so fast.
Well, or slowly. I'm almost 35.
Oh, yeah, that too, I guess. So what did you think of the Banner Saga?
It's nice. I mean, I like it. As a person who does not like strategy RPGs, you know, I enjoyed the other aspects to it, but my thing is, it's not that I don't dislike strategy RPGs, it's I am not good at them. I do not know how I ever completed Final Fantasy Tactics and, like, all the old Ogre Battle games that are, you know, one of the greatest games in the history, and you get a quarter of the way through and they just keep, you know, upping the ante on the battles, and it's like, oh god, that was the hardest battle I've ever been through and I survived. Let's next. Oh, something even harder, and they've got dragons and they get two turns for every time you get one, and there's twice as many of them. How am I supposed to get through this? But thankfully a Banner Saga is a little more merciful. I mean, not much, but you can change the difficulty on the fly to easy if you're like me, and you know, you just leave your spellcaster, like, right in the middle for three giants to just wail on them.
I have been there. I have absolutely been there.
So, what was interesting to me was the game is trying to be, you know, it has the Viking influence. It's kind of Skyrim, and it's kind of, they got their animation from Sleeping Beauty. So they tried to make it look like an old Disney animation, or it reminded me of Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings, personally. But really smooth and really animation that looks like it came from like a time in the past, but still really smooth and it's really nice.
That I think that's what I like the most about the visuals is it reminds me of, you know, my childhood. It doesn't mm-hmm. look like a modern cartoon. It looks mm-hmm. like what I grew up with.
Yeah, and it's really smooth, but it evokes a style, and it looks really good at it. It's kind of like if they ever release Cuphead. It kind of reminded me of that, where it's like you're actually, you know, playing a cartoon to a certain extent. I mean, the battle and playing stuff is overhead, and you're kind of a little bit of a distance from it, but that's still really nice, but it combines that with Oregon Trail. It's like you're playing Viking Oregon Trail, essentially.
With strategy battles in the middle.
Yeah, instead of hunting for buffalo meat. Okay, here. I mean, it's just kind of where do we begin with it? Because there's kind of a lot to talk about. It's a little game. I mean, at least the first one. The first one is about 10.5 hours, which may be short considering how you look at it. But there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of choices to do, and there's a lot of things to screw up, as I found out. Like, I learned when I finally played a cheap copy of Until Dawn, I am not very good at keeping people alive. Like, I kept making choices to where I kept getting somebody killed. Like, oh, we'll see if I can do this and keep him alive. Nope. And then let's see if I can do this and take some, like, there are some actual choices where just, you know, kind of tick you off because you're playing two people who meet in the middle who are dealing with this, the evil things called the Dredge. And they're just the evil things. And they, on one end, they took over your village and destroyed it. Now you have to go to safety, and you keep finding there's not much safety. On the other end, you're this race of giants, and you're teaming up with some humans, and you were originally going to go to, like, sign some sort of treaty, and now the Dredge screwed that up, and now you're just trying to survive with each other. So you're play two sides of that, and you're going to meet each other in the middle. And every now and then you have a choice where you have to be a leader, and you're the two main characters on each side. You play Rook, who is a human with his daughter Alette, and you're suddenly the head of the village because the chieftain died, and you got to figure out how to lead these people, and you've got to make choices that, well, some people are going to die or some people are going to leave, but if you don't, then more people are going to die, or you lose a main character, or something like that.
So it's now, very much a game of forcing you into tough choices.
Yeah. And so some of them get a little, can really put you in a pinch. Like if you, there's one where there's this village where you can't get in, and there are other ways to do it. And if you tried the sneaky way, sure, you got in the sneaky way, but you don't get to take your giant with you, who is critical for some battles. And like the first battle you get after you sink into the village, or at least the one I got, was, yeah, I needed the giant, and I kind of had to go backwards a little bit, because otherwise I would have... the only way through that was setting it on easy. Although,
yeah, in the middle of the game doesn't hold your hand, that's for sure.
Well, it does have a long tutorial, so at least you know what you're doing, but there's the unique aspect called willpower in it, where you have a certain amount of willpower, and what it does is it allows you to do a little extra damage or walk a little bit farther. What I found this did, it's handy, but it also makes your archers almost useless, because if you're in range to strike them, they have the willpower to wail on your archers, and that's what they like to do. So I had a tough time getting through that. And also there's the renown system, where how you level up is you don't get experience for acting, you get experience for killing things. So if you're a support unit like an archer, and you're better known for, you know, like wearing them down, letting the big guys up front take them down, you don't get a lot of renown, and you don't get to level up as well, unless there's a really sneaky one who's like the bodyguard of Prince Luden, who's one of the characters. He's like this human prince who's going to take over, and he's kind of a snotty bitch, and he has a bodyguard who is just this weird assassin archer lady, and you know, all the interactions like give you a creepy vibe, but she is about one of the few effective archers I've seen. And then you get the spell weavers, who practically break the game if you're not stupid like me, because they have extreme range, they can do a lot of damage, and they can, it's like when you get Cid in Final Fantasy Tactics, and he's just such a badass that it breaks the entire game, which was used to be extremely frustrating, but I think that's the only way I got through Final Fantasy Tactics was I had Cid.
And Tactics was not an easy game.
No.
Yeah, it blows my mind that you were able to make it through like the ogre battles and Final Fantasy Tactics. But
I never made it through ogre battle. I made Let Us Cling Together. I got halfway through, and then there was a battle with like four dragons, and then they had four, you know, powered up units, and I don't know if I was supposed to, grind, because it's not always clear when you're supposed to grind in Final Fantasy Tactics or ogre battles. The ogre battles of the world, and I just kind of did it in Final Fantasy Taps, because the line like, screw it, this is one of the greatest games ever, I have to get through it somehow, we're going to work with this. Although I do like Ogre Battle Let Us Cling Together story a little bit better, because it feels like after you get to a certain point in Final Fantasy Tactics, you get where the story's going. It's just like, all the nobles are evil, the church is evil, and every time you go up to somebody, it's like, oh, we're your friends. Nope, I'm totally an evil monster who's going to wreck your shit. It gets to that point where I kind of see where this story is going. But and Let Us Cling Together is a little bit more varied and interesting to me. But anyway, back to what the game we're supposed to be talking about.
I know this was a two-pack of both of the games. How do the games compare? Like, I know your story carries over from the first to the second.
It is practically a continuation. They don't do a whole lot to up the presentation. They don't do a whole lot with the battle system, as far as I could tell. But maybe it's slightly different presentation, but it is essentially you're playing the same game, and it's part two. So,
which, you know, it is called the Banner Saga 2.
So yeah, Banner Saga 2. So it is a continuation. So the story itself is fine. I found it a little dry. I don't know how you felt about it.
I personally have not played the second one yet.
Okay. Well, the story, I mean, it's practically just a continuation of the second. So what you get from the first game is what you get for the second game. It's just a question of who you pick as your main character in the second part of the Banner Saga determines how people interact with you. So, I mean, that's kind of nice. So if you choose, for spoiler reasons, I can't tell you anything because, yeah, the end of the first Banner Saga is like this big spoilerific moment. And we can't really talk about it because people die, even though a lot of people die. I mean, somebody important dies at the end of, and they have a Viking funeral and all that fun stuff. But
nice.
So you get to that, and they're just a continuation, but it's really well thought out world. It's really, you know, you go to the map and you click on things and it tells you exactly the history of the place and what it is. And there's a ton of it, even if you never go there, which is nice. But what I found was the dialogue was kind of dry. It's kind of, you know, standard epic storytelling with Viking, you know, Nordic, you know, people who are wearing horns on their head and they have honor and they're big, bristly men and, you know, they're giants and humans and they don't really like each other, but they kind of have to work together. But they don't always work well together, and the dialogue is, you know, it's fine. I didn't really find myself getting attached to the characters that much, and especially the race of giants. They're like too many guys with beards, and to where I didn't know which one I picked the wrong one, because there's one bodyguard and there's one who's the main character, and they look kind of alike. And if I can't tell a minor character from one of the main characters, that's kind of problematic, I would say.
Yeah, a lot of the characters looked very similar in the game. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just human and being racist, but they do actually talk about how the giants have very few women, and I don't remember meeting a female giant in the first one. In the second one, you do. But I think that's one of the reasons the race is dying off is because there are very few women. I'm not sure. I lost kind of the story because there's some games where you really get into the lore and you get into everything. This one wasn't so much, but it's a very basic game. So if you don't get into the lore so much, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
But, what I would say is, I mean, it's fine. Your mileage may vary depending on how much you like Viking lore and Viking style games.
So if you're looking for a good strategy RPG, I guess the question comes down to, do you pick up the original Banner Saga for $20, and if you enjoy it, then pick up the sequel and the survival mode separately, which totals $45, or do you think if you're a fan of strategy games and story heavy games that you just dive in with the bundle for $38 and save a few bucks?
There's a couple like little caveats to that. One is,
oh, there's
that
a bunch of caveats to that, but you know, we're yeah, we're looking for the
the just the PlayStation 4 version of it. I would say that's a hard thing to say because there's the PC version. It's been out for a while, and you can get bargains at plenty wherever you choose to shop. Humble Bundle, Steam, or GOG usually has like sales on this every other month, and you can generally get the first game fairly cheap. For this one, I didn't realize it was $40. That definitely takes it from buy it to try it, because it's a little expensive considering the original game has been out for a while. And
funny enough, both of them on Steam are still $20 full price.
Oh, okay, but they have
in your face, motherfucker.
Sorry, I have I have seen the original Banner Saga for $5, so I'm...
I mean, sales happen everywhere.
Sales happen everywhere. I mean, PlayStation, sometimes they have, like, really good flash sales. They've been lightening up on those as of late. I've looked at their flash sales, and it's just like, oh boy, Handball 16, I sure want that one. But, I'd say definitely try it. If you're a strategy RPG fan, I'd... you know, a little bit higher up in the tier of try it, because it is definitely, you have to be good at this game. There are, and you definitely have to have patience with it, or you can just switch it to easy. Yeah. The game makers make it easy for you to change it on the fly and just, okay, here, you're having trouble, just flip it over to easy and call it a day. But, yeah. You know, some people's pride won't let them do that.
Very
My
true.
My pride, I don't really have it, because I had to get through the game for the review, and
I'm too old for pride.
I just
throw it on easy right off the bat anymore. I just want to play games and enjoy them and move on.
Yeah, it took me years for the Persona series to, like, take it off of easy, because there's a point in Persona 3 where if you don't know what you're doing, you're just, like, everything can kill you with an instant death spell, and... it's like, oh, God. Once you die in the dungeon and you've done 2 hours of work, it's back. You're hoping it back to the start of that dungeon, and God damn, that's a pain in the ass.
Oh, man. Well, Henry, thank you so much for the review on this one.
I'm sorry. One more thing I should mention.
Oh, okay.
It's an important thing. The music is by Austin Wintory. It's very important because he's the guy who did the music to Journey. And everybody loves Journey, except the people who just want to be asshats. And the music to Journey was especially wonderful. I mean, this isn't Journey good, but it is good. It's, like, orchestrated. It fits the, you know, scenery, and it fits the mood. I mean, it's not fantastic, but the music is really good as well. I should probably throw that in.
I mean, you can't go wrong with Austin Wintory.
Yeah, no.
So... but yeah,
so now I'm done. Sorry.
Thanks again for the review. Do you have any final words on the game?
I mean, it's fine. You know, it's a really well-made game. It does what it's supposed to do. That I personally didn't get into the story doesn't mean you won't get into the story. But and just because I suck at strategy games doesn't mean everybody else does. But, I mean, it
so
does
if
what
you're
it's
good
supposed
at
to.
Strategy games, it's a series worth checking out.
Yes.
All right, for the next pack of games, we're calling in another one of our good friends, Nicole Martin, Eternal Rage. Welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm all right. How are you?
It's a long one. We got a lot of games talking about today.
Been a busy week.
Indeed. Busy week, busy weekend that I remember, and lot of reviews, so it's good to have one of these... just a shitload of reviews episode and catch up with a lot of stuff that's kind of been sitting in the backlog or kind of just getting held up a little bit. But you have a nice handful of games to talk about, and we are going to kick things off with Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, the Telltale series, developed and published by Telltale Games, Episode 1, Tangled Up in Blue, released April 18th on Xbox One, PS4, Steam, and mobile for $4.99. A season pass is available for the rest of the season for $19.99 as well. Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, the Telltale series, delivers a brand new story of the universe's unlikeliest heroes, the ragtag band of outlaws who go by the name Star-Lord, Gamora, Drax, Rocket, and Groot. In the wake of an epic battle, the Guardians discover an artifact of unspeakable power. Each of the Guardians has a reason to desire this relic, as does a ruthless enemy who is the last of her kind and who will stop at nothing to tear it from their hands. Eternal, what'd you think about this one?
I have to lead off with a disclaimer. My extent of Guardians of the Galaxy knowledge is the movie, and I don't even remember most of it. I just remember Groot. Like, I am Groot. And Rocket, I think in Rocket was just the most awesome little badass ever. But that's my extent of Guardians of the Galaxy. So going into this was kind of like a semi-fresh look. And there's not a lot in the way of backstory as to where it comes from. Like, the game basically already expects you to be pretty familiar with the characters, which is kind of kind of a swap for Telltale. They tend to give you a little bit to go from in the first episode. This one, not a whole lot. Nothing in the way of flashbacks or anything like you would get in a Walking Dead version. Mm. It's just straight in. Hey, look, here's Star-Lord. He has an a Walkman. I don't know why I about said 8-track, but a Walkman. I'm dating my own damn self.
In my day, our tapes were the size of a freaking loaf of bread.
Fucking Betamax. he has his Walkman and the 80s music. And if you're familiar at all with Guardians of the Galaxy, you're probably going to feel a little better just getting thrown into this one than if you're coming into it completely oblivious to the comics or anything like that. So I found myself quite a bit going, but why? Why am I doing this? Who's going where? As far as flashbacks and stuff goes, it limits itself. There's a moment where you flash back with Star-Lord and his mother when he's a child. And that's it. If you weren't already familiar with the other characters and their background, at this point in the series, you better hope you've already seen the movie and read some of the comics or know how to find a wiki page. Otherwise, it's your classic Telltale. It's, push a button here, look for this, touch that. It plays smoothly. It's exactly what you'd expect. I found there's some action sequences in it. And I found that the first couple, I was about to say they were kind of dull, but it redeems itself with some of the later action scenes and how they play out. I was genuinely surprised. It was definitely the later fight scenes are a big improvement over the ones in the beginning when you're just like, this is it. There's also one fight scene that is actually really well choreographed. And the Telltale games, typically you have your one character and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, you can actually, during the fight sequence, you take control of all the characters at one point or another. So that was a nice little switch. Like when one character would get knocked away by the boss, you would take control of another and then do their little moves, and then they would get knocked away and you would take control of them. So it was nice to see that, yeah, Star-Lord is your main character and he's your center of the group, but it's all of them together that makes the group work. Like, they couldn't have took him down if it wasn't for all of them.
Yeah.
So that was a nice little moment that was unexpected. And I lost my train of thought. It happens every time.
That always happens.
But overall, it's what you would expect from a Telltale game. It's got some promise, but I would have liked a little more hints as to all the characters' backgrounds instead of just being thrown into it. Oh, yeah, Drax's family is dead, and this is his revenge, and that's that. And you're like, wait, but how did they die? Why? I don't remember why they died,
So basically, if you're not familiar with the source material, it's going to be a lot harder to get into.
Yeah, it's definitely going to, you're at least look up a wiki or something and get some backstories. But otherwise, it's your classic Telltale, and it earned its buy it.
Sounds good. Does this look like something that's worth grabbing the season pass ahead of time, or just a wait-and-see kind of approach?
At the current point, yeah, I'd still say it's good for the season pass, just because I know I'm dying to know where it goes, even without, being as invested as in the characters as I would be in, say, a Walking Dead game or one of the other Telltale games, where you already have that investment in the characters, and so you want to know what happens to them because you care about them. Even though with Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm a little like, I don't know why they're doing anything, but I want to know where it goes. So I would say, yeah, go ahead and grab that season pass, and especially if you're a fan of the series. Fans of the characters that are already familiar with them, they're definitely going to want to just go ahead and grab it.
Nice. All right, sounds good. Next game to talk about, going from adventure to adventure, I guess, is called Lost Grimoires Stolen Kingdom, developed by Worldloom Games and published by Artifacts Monday. Released April 21st on Xbox One for $9.99, an alchemist apprentice runs home from university to finish her training under a great master. Little does she know, a real paranormal adventure has only just begun. Ooh. Tell me about this one.
Lost Grimoires is your typical Artifacts Monday point-and-click adventure. You know, your beautiful hand-drawn world, and each scene is absolutely as gorgeous as the one before it. Character models have the dubbing, I guess, it's not originally developed in English. And so the characters' mouths move. It's like watching a Japanese movie that's been dubbed in English at some times. If you're paying real close attention to it, it might catch you for a little while. But the dubbing isn't synced. But other than that, it's really hard to find anything to complain about. This one has, like most of them, it has kind of that surprise plot twist midway through. I found, though, that this one felt a little more predictable on its plot twist than the other ones did. Usually, it takes a little longer before you're like, hey, I think I know what's happening here. this one, like, you're a good 10 minutes in, and you're like, oh, I can see where this one's going to go. That doesn't mean it's a bad story, though.
I was going to say, and does that detract from the story at all?
I don't think it does. I think it was still enjoyable, because you want to, you still want to get to that end. You want to know if you're right. And so,
sometimes it's about the journey.
It is. Especially with the Artifacts Monday games, I find that a lot of times, yeah, even if you can guess what's going to happen, you still want to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
This Lost Grimoires is actually, I'm not sure on it for certain, but I think it may have been one of their earlier games that they developed for PC. It's not.
Well, this one shows that it's developed by Worldloom Games, so it looks like one that they're just publishing instead of internal.
It's not as fleshed out as most of the other Artifacts Monday games are. You know how most of them you'll have the hidden object puzzle, and then you'll have the option to switch to another mini game type like Dominoes or Monaco.
Yeah.
This one does not have that option. So if the hidden object puzzle is it, and surprisingly, there's not a lot of hops, like maybe 4 or 5.
Oh, wow.
That really stood out. You're like, as far as like the giant cluttered picture where you've got to find, you know, a couple dozen items, there's really not that many of them. There were a couple more smaller ones where you have to find like the random pieces of something to put together, but not the whole, here's your list of items, pick them out of the pile. I was kind of surprised by that. There is an interesting mini game alternative, though. You can't skip it. You can't choose between it or a hop. But your character is tasked with collecting items used to cast spells, because she is an alchemist. And so, I don't know if spells is technically the correct word, but she comes up with concoctions that will benefit her. In one instance, she has to put a golem to sleep so that she can get past him. And so, you need to find the items. You need to find the list of ingredients that you need will be somewhere in the scene. Then you need to find those ingredients. Then you have to open up her book, her alchemy book, and put the ingredients, use the ingredients with the book, and then it will come up with a puzzle where you have to rotate rings that have colored orbs on them, and you have to match the pattern for those orbs the way that they are to represent having mixed those ingredients together to create the concoction.
Interesting.
And then, and once you've got it mixed properly, so it'll be something like, okay, so you've got two small rings and a big ring in the middle, and you'll rotate them around to move the pieces properly. And you may have to put, say, three red orbs on the left small ring and three blue orbs on the right small ring. And then you might need to surround the center ring with all white. So, and of course the rings are interconnected. So when you move one, it moves all of them, you know, in one way or another. So it's a nice little twist in the mini game category, as to giving, you have to actually mix your concoctions. And then once you do, you get the item and then you can use it in the world. It was a nice play on the alchemy. There's not a lot of options for how you can mix alchemy into a point and click puzzle game, you know? So yeah. As far as this is how you're going to mix the ingredients, that's a really, really creative way to put that in there. And it played well. And even, you know, without using guides or anything, it wasn't overwhelmingly difficult to do it. If you set and had patience, you could move them in the right order eventually. Overall, it was... I know I said the same thing about Dark Arcana being one of the shorter ones, and this was about the same length Lost Grimoires was. So it wasn't one of the longer, and it wasn't one of the fleshier Artifacts Mundi games, yeah. But it was still, I would say it was still on par as far as being good.
All right, so for $10, what are your thoughts?
I'd buy it, yeah. It doesn't break tradition.
Good.
It's a quick... I'd like to point out, too, though, the other Artifacts games, they usually come with a bonus chapter, and you usually need two playthroughs to complete. This one, there's no bonus chapter, and you can complete it in one playthrough.
Yeah, and there's only, what, like 13 achievements this go-around?
So yeah. Yeah, because there's no alternative to the hops to play through.
Yeah.
So, I mean... It, as far as replay or having achievement hunters should rejoice, but it was a little sad to not play it through. But it does have collectibles, and so if you're not watching, you'll miss them and have to play through again anyway.
Oh, there you go. So there's always a reason to play again. And I know PC has a sequel to the game, so maybe we'll end up seeing that hit the Xbox eventually as well.
There may even be two or three.
There might be. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they're usually most of them have at this point on Steam or mobile. Most of them have pretty good amount of sequels for them.
There are over 400 hidden object puzzle games on Steam.
That is insane. But they could bring every one of them to Xbox, and I wouldn't complain.
I don't know if there are over 400. I just said that.
I still wouldn't complain. You could tell me there are 1,000. I'd be like, click all the buttons.
Bring them all.
If they're half as good as an Artifacts Mundi game, I'd be like, yeah.
Anyway, talking about like the paranormal stuff in Lost Grimoires, that kind of leads to another game that I could tackle myself. Voodoo Vince Remastered, developed and published by Beep Games, originally published on the original Xbox by Microsoft Studios. So it was exciting to get this one. And if you didn't listen to our last episode with Clayton of Beep Games, go back and listen to that show because it was awesome. Voodoo Vince Remastered released April 18th on Xbox One, Windows 10, and Steam for $14.99. It is an Xbox Play Anywhere title, so if you get it on Xbox One, you also get it on Windows 10 and vice versa. And no, that does not include the Steam version. That is a completely separate purchase. The classic character platformer is back after 13 years and newly remastered. Help Vince run, jump, and fight his way through cemeteries, swamps, and an evil carnival as he seeks to save his creator, Madame Charmaine, from the evil clutches of Cosmo the Inscrutable. Did you ever play the original Voodoo Vince?
I did not. We had an original Xbox and I think we might have had it for a week, and David resold it. I didn't get to play shit.
See, I played the original way back when, so when I heard that it was getting a remaster, I was pretty excited about it coming back. The remaster, I mentioned this in the interview, I honestly thought when it was announced it was going to be like a $30 game. So coming out at $15 already is like bonus points in my eyes, because they definitely could have charged more for this. It is your standard 3D platformer. We've seen a bunch of those coming out recently with Yooka-Laylee and Snake Pass. This does have a similar downfall as the others, in that the camera can get frustrating. My biggest issue I had with the camera was there's times where, you know, in platformers, you want to position the camera the best way so that you can make jumps. Usually in platforming, I'll usually like put it above me so I could look down where I have to land.
Yeah.
But this game, a lot of times the camera just wants to snap back behind you slowly. So no matter what you do, the camera's like, no, I'm going back over here, which led to a couple frustrating deaths. But what are you going to do? It is platforming.
It's typical retro platforming butt cam is what I call it. It just likes to stay on your butt.
Yeah. Thankfully, in this one, when you do fall down like a pit or in water and die, it pretty much places you back on the last solid ground that you were on, so you could give it another go. So that there's not too much of a penalty for screwing up. And as Clayton mentioned in the interview last week, there are easy ways to go back and grind for extra lives. So
it's pretty forgiving.
Yeah, definitely forgiving if you go back and grind. If not, it just boots you back to the main menu and, you know, you just recontinue where you were. But that starts the level over and you're going to lose some shit there. So do your level grinding. Otherwise, the game is just solid action adventure platformer. You have a handful of basic attacks, punches, you have a spin attack, you have a jumping ground pounding attack, and then as you defeat enemies, they'll drop little beads that you could pick up that'll charge up your voodoo gauge, and you can find all these different voodoo powers through the levels, and when your gauge is full, you just hit the triggers and you unleash a voodoo attack that hits all of the nearby enemies and kills them dead.
So the main character is a little voodoo doll. What kind of enemies does he face?
Just little monsters.
Are they little monsters?
Yeah. There's like,
see, other than the occasional like screen grab of the main character, I haven't seen anything about Voodoo Vance's except for everybody saying, "Oh, it's amazing." So I'd like a little, you know, like
they're like little,
am I fighting zombies,
beetle-ish characters? They look like little beetle monsters. I mean, you're a tiny little doll, so of course you're going to be, you know, you're maybe shin high, so you're going to be fighting tinier things. But, you know, like, bugs will be flying around, dropping spiky bombs at you. You'll have little beetle enemies running at you that you got to take out. There's some big bosses in the game, like gigantic dragon enemy that fucks your day up really bad. We were talking about that in the show. I don't want to go on too long about it just because, you know, we did have the interview with them. But I did want to give it my official verdict. And that for $15, and the fact that it's a Play Anywhere title, so you get it on Xbox One and Windows 10, This is a buy it. I miss these days of Microsoft when they would just take risks and put out different games instead of, you know, Gears every other year, Halo every other year, Forza every year between Horizon and just standard. You know, back in the early original Xbox days, they tried new things, and this is a result of that, and I'm thrilled that after 13 years, it's back, and who knows, maybe it'll sell well enough to garner a sequel, so fucking buy this game and help a sequel get made.
Nice. I may have to keep an eye out for it.
It's only $15. Do it.
It is. Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah, you said 15. I was surprised because with everybody talking about it, I'm like, oh, that's a $30 game.
Yeah, that seriously, so when I'm impressed. Announced, that's what I thought it was going to be. I kind of feel the same of like a Phantom, what the hell, Phantom Dust. I have a feeling that's going to be like a $30 game. So maybe that'll surprise us and come out at 15 or 20 as well.
So about how many hours do you think it would take to get through Voodoo Ants?
It depends on if you go after all the collectibles or if you just kind of want to run through it. I'd say you could get anywhere from 6 to 10 hours.
Nice.
So there's definitely plenty of time there.
That's not bad for a $15 game. You can't shake a stick at that.
Yeah, it just depends on how quick you want to run through. So.
And the only complaint is butt cam.
Yeah, there's some frustrating platforming because of the camera, but I think the camera is really my only honest gripe of the game. So, what are you going to do? Anyway, we got one more game from you, and that is, hopefully I say this right, Invalor Verstand, I think. Developed and published by Scobie Jack Games, which another name I hope I got right. Scobie Jack, who knows? Released April 21st on Xbox One for $14.99, previously available on Steam. Be prepared to be transported to a reality of dreams and nightmares. What will you discover about yourself in this journey through the subconscious? In these realms of the unknown, you must travel through labyrinths of memories to eventually find your own truth. Cole, tell me about this one, because it sounds incredibly interesting.
This game is odd. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Let's clear that up out of the way. It's lengthy. There are 18 levels, and each level is basically, it's all first person, and it's an exploratory experience, if you will. And the goal is to get from where you start to a tree. Every level has one tree, and you have to reach that tree. And there are a variety of obstacles that can get in your way. Or there may even, some of the levels have platforming that will just make it a little more difficult to get to your tree.
Interesting.
It's surprisingly minimalistic. The very first level is just, hey, walk a straight line. Get from here to that tree, no questions asked. And then you do it, and you're like, hooray! This can't be so bad.
I walked.
But yeah, you're like, yeah! I can even run if I want to. There's no timers. There's no monsters. There's just, the only obstacles are, hey, you may have to jump a couple rocks if you want to get to that tree. But as it progresses, some of them obviously become more difficult, or they may seem easy enough in the start. Once you actually start trying to make that journey, it gets real. You know, you may be like, hey, I'm just skipping a few rocks and it's no big deal, but then you may get halfway there and find that rocks are starting to crumble as soon as you land on them now, and so you have to step up your platforming a little if you're really going to get there. It's not complicated. Even in the platforming, it's mostly responsive, but sometimes it can be a little difficult to gauge if a jump is going to be successful or not.
Yeah.
And that can change even between levels, because there's one level where you're jumping over rocks, and you really, even if you get a run and go, it'll help, but you can't get very far. And so you kind of have to just, like, push yourself and hope you don't fall off 15 times like I did. On the other hand, at least it gives you an achievement for dying 10 times.
You mentioned achievements, and I'm not sure if you're going to bring this up in your review at all, but I love the fact that this game has weird achievements in it.
It's because it's a weird game.
Like, I know if CJ were here, he would probably cry at the fact that, like, finish scene one gets you one achievement point.
Mm-hmm.
I I love shit like that. Like, I love it when games put out achievements with weird values.
I've been stuck with, like, 8 as my last number for a while, so I'm kind of hoping this might even me out. But the frustrating part is, like, I'm halfway through, and I think I've got 74 out of 1,000.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, come on. But, that is something to... You know, if you enjoy odd-numbered games or you're trying to even your gamer score back out, this one's going to help you out. If you hate those, keep that in mind. You don't play this unless you're going to 1K it. And 1K-ing it is not going to come easy. Like I said, I'm a little more than halfway through, and I've only got 74 out of 1,000 gamer score because you complete all of the levels, and then it unlocks them for time trials. And so then that steps it up, because once there are time limits on them, and if you can complete them, even some of the more complicated ones, as happy accidents. I mean, if you wander long enough, you're going to find your way to that tree.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to run a time trial, you're really going to have to think deliberately about where you're going. Every time you take a step, if you don't run, or if you do run, if you don't time, one of the levels, you have to go through fire. And when you do, it will trigger rocks in another area to move or what have you. So if you're trying to run a time trial, you can't do that over and over till you figure out which set of rocks moved. You're going to already have to know your path. Aye. Otherwise, you're just going to be standing there and be like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to just jump off the cliff now. There are checkpoints throughout the levels in the event that you do either fall off accidentally or just get frustrated and kill yourself out of misery. I might have done that a couple of times. The checkpoints, though, you have no idea where there are. There's nothing to indicate it's a checkpoint. So basically, like, you may find that you come right back to where you were, or you may find that you are half the map away and you've got to make it all over again. I wish there was some kind of indicator. I know that they tried to keep everything minimal, but just like a blinking light would be good or something to indicate that you've hit a checkpoint.
Yeah.
So it can be a little frustrating if you're trying to plan, and with the time trials, especially, like, have I made it to a checkpoint if I fall here, or am I going to get started 6 miles back? So, because you don't know otherwise.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though, the sheer variety of level obstacles and stuff that there is. Even as minimal as it is, like, you may find one level you start on a highway, and there's these giant, almost like Humvees, like military Humvees that come flying past you, and then once they get past you, they hit an obstruction in the road and they explode. And you're just like, you know, cut off by it. But the only thing you can do is walk. There's nowhere to go. You can't get off of the highway. You can't jump or climb over anything. You just have to walk down that road. So, obviously, if you walk in front of where that Humvee is coming from, you're going to get pancaked.
Yeah.
But if you stay walking on the side of the road where the Humvee is not, eventually one's going to come from the other side and flatten you, too. So then you have to become aware, oh shit, I'm going to die if I'm not paying attention to the fact that they are coming from both sides now. And there's nothing to indicate when they're going to start coming from behind you as well. Yes, I got pancaked. A lot. And then you don't know whether to trust yourself when you do get to the other side. You have to walk around the obstruction that's also there to continue on to get to your tree. And so you're like, wait, though, on the other end, when I went that way, I got pancaked. So if I go this way now, that's the only way I can go, though. If I go over there, I'm going to get pancaked. So then you have to decide, is it worth trying to go Or am I going to get pancaked? I don't want to be a pancake. it's stressful because you're like, all I did was walk down a highway and I don't know whether I can go or not. And I think that might have been the existentialism that the developers were aiming for. And if not, that's what they got out of me anyway. There was definitely some existentialism going on. There's another level where, you know, it, like I said, the first level, you just walk. There's no, you know, obstructions or anything. You just to the tree and you're happy. And then there's a later level and you're like, hey, it's just a field with a tree again. I know how to do this. And then you take a few steps and you get pancaked from falling totems that just come out of nowhere from the sky. And then after I got smashed like 18 times, I look up and I'm like, I don't get to just walk across the field. I have to stare at the sky and make sure I'm not going to get pancaked by falling totems. I don't know what they're...
I love your anger.
I don't know how much gold to pancake me. What did I do? I had like so much existentialism out of this little $15 game. And it's so minimal. It's just like... Every time I got squished, I was like, but I just want to get to the tree.
Oh, God.
That's all you want to do in life is reach that tree. So ultimately, I found myself, I just wanted to replay it because I was like, how are they going to fuck me over next time? Like, what could the next scene possibly throw at me that an exploding Humvee and raining totems can't?
Yeah.
How many more ways can you guys just... splat me into the ground.
That's so funny.
It was... I can't explain why I was so drawn. I just wanted to go to the next scene. And what could they possibly do when all I wanted to do was get to that tree?
Oh, man. Oh. So for $15, was the tree finding worth it?
I give it a solid try it. I really do. I think that there's... It's kind of niche, and there's not a lot of people that are really gonna, you know, jump at that kind of game. But if you like the unusual, if you like mazes, there was a lot of maze quality to a lot of the levels. So if you like that, and you want to, you just want to have an existential crisis over a tree, this is the game for you.
Nice.
So I do give it a solid try. It, yeah.
All right, sounds good.
I also got to throw in there that it's the first ID at Xbox game to come from Africa.
Nice.
We forgot that.
That's cool too. So what is it? South Africa? Is it from?
I believe so. Yeah. You know how like when you're playing a multiplayer game and it shows you the world map of who's all online and there's always that one dot in Africa.
This is them.
This might have been those guys.
Nice. I know people were trying to figure out what the title meant, and people are trying to say, oh, it's like a, it seems like a weird take on German, but it's actually the South African language, Afrikaans or Afrikaans, okay. however yeah. You say it.
I know how that's spelled, but I ain't even going to try to pronounce it because redneck.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I wonder what it means. I think it means existential crisis by tree.
I'm trying to think. It apparently means a lost mind.
I can see where that's a good explanation for the game, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're basically just wondering.
Someone on Xbox Achievements confirmed it with the developer. So it stands for a lost mind.
It's a fitting title, and it's a good explanation for the, because you are basically just wondering, and like, all you want to do is get to that tree, and the tree evades you. And then you get pancaked by a Humvee.
True. Gotta love I'm hungry for pancakes now.
You're welcome.
So thank you, Cole, as always, for your reviews. I know we will have you back again next weekend. I can't wait for your appearance then. Do you have any final words to sum up your reviews here?
Try them all out. You never know. You might find you like one you didn't think you would.
All right, next game to talk about is called Panzer Panic VR, developed and published by Handy Games. It released March 15th on Steam VR for $9.99 and requires an Oculus or Vive headset. Battle your friends in an action-packed tank VR multiplayer game. I clearly don't own an Oculus or a Vive myself, so I got my friend Chris Serrani on the case. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good, aside from, you know, microphone issues, but... You know, what do you do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Yeah, fuck it. Fuck it. What are you going to do? So this is your first time on the show, by the way. So welcome. Well, technically.
Is it? I thought I blabbed at you once before eons ago, but I don't remember.
Actually, technically, you were at one of the MAGFest room party episodes.
That's right. We used my my field recorder to record that.
And that, like, the audio was just... That was a rough one.
You know, we made do with what we had, and people could audibly be heard on occasion.
Indeed. I think Norg is the one who, like, ran it through a compressor and got it sounding decent enough.
Nice. Actually, I can't remember if all we used was, like, the internal mic on it or if I had another one plugged in, but whatever.
All I remember is that the microphone was facing away from me, so me, the one who talked the most on the show, was the least audible person.
Oh, man, I remember we also took pictures during that, because I think, yeah, wasn't it Andreas that was laying on the bed and, like, somebody else spooned him or something? Or
probably. There was a lot of fun stuff going on there.
MAGFest
shows are fun. I need to do another one soon.
Most MAGFest anything is fun, except for the drive there. 1,400 miles, what's wrong with me?
So anyway, Panzer Panic VR, we should probably talk about the game here. What is Panzer Panic VR?
Well, it's basically a virtual reality tank simulator. I mean, it's really just a big capture the flag thing from what I was playing with it. Now, unfortunately, couldn't do multiplayer stuff with it just because I went down to my buddy's place who has a whole Oculus setup in his garage. Which is actually pretty ideal, because there's plenty of room to stand. So yeah, I could only do, like, the single player with AI kind of stuff. But yeah, so, you know, kind of first impression of it. You know, graphically, I think it's completely fine for what it's trying to do. Really no need to make graphics any prettier than they need to be.
I enjoy the fact that it's colorful. That's what I like about Handy Games, is they have a very bright, cartoony feel to them, and it's not just another brown and gray dark tank war game. It's like a happy
tank war game. And actually, I think, like, a lot of the bright color stuff and contrast helps in the headset itself. I mean, the VR display stuff is way different than looking at your computer monitor. So getting the graphics... tailored towards a VR headset is definitely important. So I think they're definitely fine in that regard. And, you know, definitely no sickness feelings or motion issues or anything with how everything is set up. I'm not sure what engine it's made in.
I don't know.
But, and, you know, all the audio stuff good too. You know, good sound effects. Music was fine. So I ended up playing this, like, two different nights, you know, once for, like, 20 minutes, another time for another 20 minutes or so. So, you know, not a ton of time into it, but I was able to get a good sense of things. let's see. So on, like, the first initial play, you know, it made pretty good sense on, you know, how to do the controls. It started off in the default, where basically you're using your Oculus Touch controllers to grip the control sticks of the tank. So, you know, as you're standing there, it's like you move your arms forward, tank moves forward. You move one of your arms back, the tank will turn. Pull your arms back completely, tank goes in reverse. And nice. Then obviously your head turning is the gun turret. So wherever you're looking is where you're going to shoot.
Makes sense. So,
I mean, initial thoughts of that control scheme became a little bit difficult at times, because you know, you're standing and you're trying to do these constant arm movements while turning your head, but then also the way the whole I guess the aiming system and whatever works, you're actually having to start rotating your body as you go because things don't really auto-center. So, you know, you're putting the tank one way, and you're having to turn your head more and more another way, and then eventually, you know, you're facing sideways or backwards, but you're still going forward in the game. So it becomes a little weirdly disorienting in that manner. On the second playthrough, I ended up realizing you could change the control scheme a bit. You could either, I think, kind of just use your head to control like where the tank went, or you could use just one of the joysticks on the touch controller to steer it. I found the joystick method to be the best for me. I also found out at the same time, though, that this is really not a game that you can play sitting down, which is unfortunate because, you know, if you're driving a tank, you're sitting. So I guess it feels more comfortable to sit in a chair and drive a fucking tank around. So, I mean, maybe there's a setting to change that. I didn't discover it right away.
I know it says it requires a play area with 360 degree tracking, so I guess it just expects you to be turning and moving. And
I mean, if it was possible to, you know, fix the issue with how it would at least allow you to keep facing forward towards your screen, because, you know, not everyone's going to have like super long extensions on their Oculus headset, so you're kind of limited with your motion. So if you have to keep spinning around over and over, it's like, oh, shit!
I'm more curious to know who has four Oculus setups to have local multiplayer.
Well, yeah, because first of all, those things aren't cheap, dude. That's why I don't own one. I still got my DK2 kit, but I'm probably never going to touch the thing again, sadly. I'd love to use it again, but I'd have to buy controllers to even use it with anything now. Which sucks. I want to play Job Simulator since I'm in that, but damn it.
I still have to pick that up for PlayStation VR sometime.
Yeah. Maybe we'll discuss that later, but I'll keep that on my mind. Anyway, so let's see. Other things with the game. I've never really played much for Capture the Flag style games, so I understood the concept of it. Okay, go towards enemy, get flag back. But for some reason, like, I kept sort of getting a little bit lost in things. Like, okay, I got the flag, and now, oh, wait. Oh, apparently they got my flag, and I got to, wait, I have to go and retrieve my flag while I'm holding their flag? I thought I put their flag on my thing. I'm just an idiot, but whatever. I think another little gripe I had was it seemed like the game started a bit slow.
Well, they are tanks, to be
fair. Well, I mean, you start in a slow tank. It's like, I can't remember, like, whatever, like, driving simulator games. You start with a crappy car or something, and then you can upgrade. Mm-hmm. So same kind of concept here. It's, you know, you start with the worst tank possible, but I guess I don't really know what accomplishments you have to make in the game to be able to unlock the bigger, better, faster tanks. So, you know, for a first-time player of the game, it's like, come on, tank! Go!
You can do it!
And it's trying to maybe do evasive maneuvers or anything where it's like, I'm getting shot at, I'm getting hit, not much I can do about it, guess I'll keep... and I'm dead, fuck. So, I mean, probably most typical gamers like me or you or others, we're probably not going to read the complete instructions, if at all, on, you know, how to actually progress in a game like that. It's just, dude, let's load it up and blow stuff up. So
true.
So, I mean, maybe, I don't know if there was a way to have a little more clear, quick objectives or something, like if they had some quick tutorial pop-ups, which, you know, could be annoying too, but at least, hey, you need to do this to accomplish this. Just a quick thing. Now, that may have been a little bit helpful. So, I mean, overall, I think if you actually put some good serious time into the game and really got the control schema down to where it was, you know, just second nature and not having to really think about it, I think you could actually have a lot more fun with it. So, but in like a shorter, you know, 40 to 50 minutes that I had into it, it just, you know, kind of became frustrating here and there. But
it seems like it'd be good for a party, though. Like if you were able to get that kind of setup and have everyone together, it seems like it'd be a crazy time.
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be way more fun being frustrated at controls and stuff while you're screaming at your friends that are in the same room that you're trying to kill versus screaming at the AI and going, why?
So overall, for $10, what do you think?
I think for $10, it would definitely be a game worth putting time into, like I said. I mean, if you're going to only give it a quick chance, it's probably not going to be worth your $10, but if you actually play the game for a bit and get the controls down and actually have friends to do multiplayer with that have the hardware, you're probably going to have a lot of fun.
Awesome. So. Sounds good. Well, Chris, thank you for doing this review. Do you have any final words for the game?
I think the developer did a pretty good job. It'd be interesting to see any other things that they have in development.
Oh, they have some cool games out. I like handy games, so...
Cool, cool. Well, I mean, kudos to them. Hopefully, I'll probably play this game a bit more when I visit my friend more, so I might be able to give you like an updated review someday, too.
Cool. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. Final game to talk about on this episode is the Disney Afternoon Collection. And when we talk about retro gaming and NES classics, the best one to call on this one is Chris Taylor. So, Chris, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing Disney-tastic.
Disney-tastic.
I don't know.
So, Disney Afternoon Collection is a package of DuckTales 1 and 2, Rescue Rangers 1 and 2, Darkwing Duck and Tailspin, all from the NES.
Yes.
And you own, what, 5 of those?
I have all of them but Chip and Dale 2.
Which
on NES
mind.
Cartridges.
Which blows my mind. Especially because DuckTales 2 is not a cheap game to obtain these days.
Yeah, it wasn't that cheap to obtain for me either, but I got it for a pretty good deal.
How much?
And yeah, it's... Oh, come on now. That's not what we talk about here.
Oh, come on. What did you pay for it?
It was less than a Franklin, let's say that much.
So you got a really good deal on it.
Yes.
Because that thing could get like $200-$300 now.
Oh, I know. And Chip 'n Dale 2 is just as bad, so I'm just going to have to wait around for a similar deal to get that. Because that's a good game. And, but that's a good segue into talking about what a great collection this is.
Indeed. So instead of paying $300 for a single game, the Disney Afternoon Collection, developed and published by Capcom, released April 18th on Xbox One, PS4, and Steam for only $19.99, significantly cheaper than the aforementioned $300.
It's cheaper than all of them, really, than any one of them.
Which is nuts. Starring a cast of beloved Disney characters, the Disney Afternoon Collection takes you back to a golden era of gaming and afternoons filled with adventure. All 6 classic games feature new and improved visuals and include filtering options that replicate a retro look and feel. Chris, tell me about the Disney Afternoon Collection.
Well, first, I do want to correct you on a little bit of a thing there. You said developed and published by Capcom, but actually... Backbone is the developer, which is it's a merger between Digital Eclipse and another company I've not heard of. I do know a Digital Eclipse though. Actually,
interesting.
Yeah. I used to pal around with at least one person that works for them. So I think he had him on the show once, Frank Cifaldi.
No, we haven't had him on.
Oh, okay, that's fine. He's a charming bloke though. So if you ever get him on, but
I would love to have him on sometime.
Funny enough, just a little bit of a thing I noticed is because, okay, so I know I've met Frank a couple of times. He knows like basically who I am. And our mutual friend is a former roommate of mine who I noticed had the top number one slot in the DuckTales speedrun leaderboard that the game has. So what, I checked the leaderboard as soon as I got it, and I noticed my ex-roommate's name right at the top of the list. So he obviously got to try it early, but also he's super good at DuckTales, so it made me happy to see that there.
Nice.
So, okay, Disney Afternoon Collection, yes, it's basically, I think, the most brilliant idea in all of retro compilations, for a couple of reasons. One is that I don't know a single person who doesn't like a Disney game on the NES, like a Disney Capcom game.
True.
Like, they did the Little Mermaid ride, for goodness sakes. It's like, you know, pretty much everything that they did was great, except obviously Tailspin. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So these are high quality Capcom games that you would not, unlike something like Digital Eclipse put together the Mega Man Legacy Collection from a couple of years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first six Mega Mans, sort of packaged together, some extra little challenges added in, but the games themselves were completely untouched. Like, they're perfect ports of the NES carts. Like, everything, like the glitchiness in Mega Man 3, like the little graphical error that's above Shadow Man's portrait, like, it retains all of that. But unlike Mega Man, which has been, like, I've just played through most of the PS2 Anniversary Collection, and that came out on GameCube, was unreleased on Game Boy Advance, almost came out there. All those games are available on 3DS, they're available on the Wii Virtual Console, the Wii U Virtual Console, I imagine they're probably on Switch. You can buy them on, you know, Xbox One, PS4, all this other stuff. It's like, you can have so much Mega Man, like... more Mega Man than you'll ever be able to swallow. And the reason is because, you know, Capcom likes to put out these compilations. They sell pretty well. The thing is, the Disney Afternoon Collection is so brilliant because you aren't going to see it everywhere. Because Disney has such a strangled hold on their properties, you know, it's basically like opening the vault and getting, you know, that special video release or whatever of a classic movie. It's like, the planets have to align in order for a Disney game to be like re-released on a different system and in a different time. So that's kind of what's happening here. We've got these high quality Disney Capcom jams that haven't been re-released since their original releases because of Disney. And, not because of demand. Obviously DuckTales is one of, I mean, you could ask most Nintendo fans like what their top 20 NES games are. They'll throw DuckTales in there.
Yeah.
And the sequel, which I think is even better, is there. So it's a brilliant release for that reason. And the other reason is just the sheer value. Like you said, $20 for $20 for five amazing games and Tailspin.
You are not a Tailspin fan, are you?
I love Tailspin when it was a TV show. The NES game is not my favorite. It's because it's a weird shooter. But anyway, so should I describe the games in case the audience at home doesn't know what they are?
You could give a quick rundowns of how they are, because DuckTales are basically going to be the same across the two. Rescue Rangers is fairly same across the two.
Yeah, so, okay. The thing about like the Disney Afternoon games is that a lot of them coincided with Mega Man releases as they developed new engines, it seems like, because DuckTales and Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers came out around the, you know, 89 and 90, so that was like around the Mega Man 2 era, and I think DuckTales, if it wasn't built on the Mega Man 2 engine, I know that, for instance, the sound effects person is the same. So it's some people, I believe Inafune might have had something to do with it too. But either way, it's like a lot of Mega Man people worked on DuckTales, and you can actually see similarities the way Scrooge walks and the way Mega Man walks. But instead of shooting, you have this this pogo stick cane that that Scrooge can wield, and you use it to basically get through the stages and collect treasures in order to, you know, maintain your top of the food chain status that we're seeing a lot of today's society. Like, he's the richest duck in the world, but he is going to stay that way, gosh darn it. But actually, between DuckTales 1 and 2, since, like I said, I own both the games, I've played them both quite a lot. The second one is actually, I think, a little bit better because it kind of introduces a Metroidvania element, because you can upgrade yourself at the end of every stage by spending some of that hard stolen money on on extra lives, and like there's some other little cool things you can get, and you also get upgrades to your pogoing ability, and you also have to collect pieces of a treasure map by accessing secret areas, so you wind up revisiting levels, and so it's a lot more fleshed out. I really recommend people that pick up this compilation, give DuckTales 2 an earnest try, because it's super good. It just doesn't have, you know, the moon theme, which is everybody's favorite piece of music.
I think we've played it twice on the show in the past month or so.
Yeah, no, it's super good. It's a great song.
I'll probably play it again this episode, too.
Hey, there you go. Do it. So then you've got Chip and Dale, which is a really bizarrely scaled platformer starring everybody's favorite Magnum P.I. and, I don't know, Indiana Jones knockoffs. I don't really know what Chip and Dale really are, but they solve mysteries. But in the game, practically, it's just you jump around and pick up things and throw them. And that's kind of it. They're sort of like, it's this weird thing where it's like the sprite of the animals are one size of the chipmunks, and then like you might go against like a dog or something and he's twice as big as your character, but then you might be walking on a dinner plate that's like 20 times as big as your character, and thus 10 times bigger than a dog. It's like, I don't know, it's one of those only on the NES type of things.
Yeah,
and but I do like that game a lot because it has big, huge bosses that are really cool. And it's just the bizarre factor is fun to me. But probably my favorite game, just as a singular game, is Darkwing Duck, because not only was it my favorite show on the Disney Afternoon, the NES game is essentially Mega Man, but with a little bit, like, the boss fights are a little more puzzly. And it uses a little bit more like Ninja Gaiden style, clinging on to things like action. But given that it's a 1992 NES game, like, it really shows off a lot of polish. And the soundtrack is super great. It's this jazzy, you know, soundtrack noir that was written by the same guy who wrote the music to Mega Man 3, which is the cool like bluesy music. So it's got like jazz and blues, and the soundtrack is stellar in that one. And then there's Tailspin. Tailspin is just a really awkward shooter. Like, you play Baloo the Bear, and you're in the I forget what it's called already. The, what was his ship called? I can't.
The Sea Duck? No, what the fuck
was it? The Sea Duck. Yeah, you got it.
Was it the Sea Duck?
What was the ship called in Tailspin?
It is the Sea Duck, all right.
Yeah, good job.
Yay!
Hey, so you play Baloo in the Sea Duck, and you shoot down, like, endless clones of Don Carnasty, the bad guy, and, like, the rest of the pirates. And it's one of those shooters where...
Don Carnasty?
Isn't that his name?
I thought it was Don Carnage.
Don Carnage. Oh, yeah, that's probably it.
I'm just going to pull up a fucking Tailspin wiki right now.
Yes. Yeah, please, be ready to correct me on everything. No, I'm seeing it now. It's Don Carnage.
Baloo von Bruinwald the 13th. Is that really his friggin' name?
That sounds about right.
What the hell?
So anyway, yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, so you're doing a side-scrolling shooter, like think Gradius or something. And when you start to move upward, the ship shoots upward. And then if you start to move downward, the ship shoots downward. And I don't think it even shoots in a straight line. And even if it did, you can't move while doing it. So it's one of those things where it's like, you really have to play it differently than it has a different set of rules than what you'd be used to. Plus, you can actually turn the ship around and face the other way. Which, I mean, the game, like all the games, actually, it does not hold your hand through this. It just throws you in, and it's instantly, like, challenging. So it's like, while you're sitting there learning the controls, it's over there punishing you as if you were a veteran. And actually, that's one of the things that was sort of, I was reminded of while playing these, just kind of all in a row. It's like, the Disney Afternoon games are a different, they're from a different time and a different breed. They are brutally difficult by today's standards.
Yeah.
Like if you, they, it kind of belies their cuteness. And it's like, I think, I don't know, I would say DuckTales and maybe the original Chip and Dale are pretty okay on difficulty. But these are definitely games that you're going to have to, you know, really work on and learn and such. And what I like about this collection is that you can do that. And unlike the NES version, which almost all of which featured limited continues, like I think, does Darkwing Duck have limited continues? I think Darkwing Duck might not. But DuckTales had one continue. DuckTales 2 had, well, you could purchase more continues, but I think it, by default, had one. Chip and Dale are limited. I don't know about Tailspin because, Tailspin. But the game actually features a save feature, so you can now save your game. And I find that very handy. And actually, the features on this collection are super good. Like, for the fact that they didn't touch the games at all, they have so many, like, good things that you can do outside of the game.
So tell us about some of the new additions. I know the big thing that they publicized is that they have a rewind feature now.
Yes. Okay, so now, just like older emulators, it has a rewind button. You push the, I think, L2 shoulder down, and it just rewinds whatever you did, good or bad. And so you just get to do stuff over. So that's kind of an instant, whoops, I didn't mean to do that kind of move. That you can then do, and that will really help you practice other sections too. If you're, you know, if you're looking to be like, well, how do I pogo stick across these spikes without hitting the ceiling spikes? You know, you might try that a few times before you get it right. And while it's kind of like, I guess, tantamount to cheating, it's one of those things where it's like, well, the limited continue thing is kind of cheating anyway.
Yeah,
that's just a way that they artificially lengthen the games to begin with. So while I don't condone having too easy of a time with it, it's like, it's kind of all fairness. But yeah, you can save it, you can rewind it. It actually has different monitor modes. And again, this is telling of the developer's emulation roots, because you have a non-filter, which it's going to play in, you know, PS4, you know, this upconverted 1080p look, which is really, really pretty. The games look great in the new, you know, in these up conversions. But then you can put it in television mode, which adds a, I think, a kind of trailing interlace look. It's fairly authentic, but obviously, you know, nothing's going to look quite like a tube TV. But yeah, that might just be because that's what I still play on. But I played all of these on our 40-inch, you know, 1080p, what's the other thing that they do now? 4K.
Oh yeah, 4K.
Yeah, it's a 4K, but we don't have a PS4 Pro, so that doesn't matter. Anyway, so it does television mode, which is fine. A lot of things do that, but then it does monitor mode, which makes you feel like you're playing on an old monitor, such as the ones that you would play like an old emulator through. So it looks a little bit better than the television, but not quite the clarity of, you know, having no filter whatsoever. And I feel like that was put in there for the emulation crowd. just like the early emulation crowd of like the 90s or whatever. Let's see. The other good thing about it is online leaderboards. As I mentioned before, you can now, if you get so good at these games, you can speed run them, or, you know, if you just want to see how fast other people are at it, then you can challenge the, you can do the leaderboard thing. And also, it has a time attack mode just within the game. So it's like you can go into the game with a timer and see how fast you can beat things. And a couple of the games have a boss rush challenge, which is really cool. So it's like there's so many things that you can do, like, outside of just playing, you know, six or five super expensive, like, not, well, I guess two of them are super expensive games. Besides being able to play these, you know, on a system totally legit and, you know, Disney approved, you can also, you know, do all this other stuff. Oh, and speaking of Disney approved, I kind of laughed a little bit at the title screen and the menus because they have that Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, like, confetti look to them.
Oh, like, God.
It doesn't even look like Disney Afternoon type stuff. Like, you know, I remember the Disney Afternoon and it didn't look like that. It looks more like something you'd see on the modern Disney Channel. And and when you start the game, it does, like, this Mickey Mouse silhouette that, like, closes in on it. And I was like, this is Disney reminding you that their mark is all over this.
Oh, man. I miss these cartoons. I wish the old Toon Disney was back. Like, when that station first showed up before it got ruined with, like, Mary-Kate and Ashley cartoons, and then they changed it to whatever the hell it is now. They had Toon Disney. It was just, like, 24-hour channel of classic Disney Afternoon cartoons.
That is awesome, yeah. I do like that. And, actually, in, you know, I am looking forward to... I've seen, like, some of these Disney XD shows, like Gravity Falls and such, and I think they're really good. Like, they're kind of bringing back that thing, but a little bit more for adults, I suppose.
Yeah, XD, that's what it turned into. Disney XD.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's got some good stuff, and plus they're bringing back DuckTales from...
I am cautiously optimistic about the new DuckTales.
They've got one of the Doctor Who doctors as Scrooge McDuck. I'm all for it. An actual Scottish person? Come on, that's awesome. And I'm really glad that at least, you know, in your DuckTales remastered, they got Alan Young to do the voice one more time. So
the late Alan Young, rest in peace.
Yeah. RIP.
That was my childhood when he went.
RIP Wilbur. You know he was Wilbur on Mr. Ed, right?
Yeah. Alan Young did a lot.
Oh, yeah, he did.
So if someone already has DuckTales remastered, do you think that it's still worth picking up Disney Afternoon, considering the other games that are there?
Yeah, I would say so.
Or if you have Disney Afternoon, is it still worth tracking down DuckTales remastered?
Well, here's the thing, is that these are two different sides of when retro games get revisited. So with DuckTales remastered, with, I don't know, Mega Man powered up, Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins, let's just, like, you know, Capcom has remade their games so many times. Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD, if you remember that. And they're always hit or miss. I think that, you know, you've got all those on one side where they reskin or totally redesign the entire game. And then, you know, those have their fans, so, like, people who like the something about the old games, but they want to see it in modern, in a modern context, like the Monster Boy remakes. So you've got that side of it. And for those folks, for sure. Yeah. I mean, DuckTales remastered is a solid remaster. It's, the soundtrack is incredibly, like, redone. And again, the original voice cast, especially now that we don't have the original Scrooge McDuck with us anymore.
No.
And then there are people who want the original experience verbatim, like people who shop on the virtual console on the Nintendo systems, people who picked up Mega Man Legacy Collection, or to a lesser extent, the Anniversary Collection, because they actually messed with some stuff in the Anniversary Collection. I have mixed feelings about that. So for the purists who really want to play, you know, these games on their flat panel HD, 4K, you know, 120 hertz, whatevers, you know, this is like five of some of the best games that you can play on the NES and Tailspin.
And, that's still funny every time you do it. There's six, five.
And these are games that you're never going to see on an NES Classic Edition or whatever, which that's another example of what this is the game itself is untouched, but the dressing around it is updated for today's modern player.
It still blows my mind that this is not available on the Switch.
Is it not? Well, I mean, maybe they're working on it. I don't know.
Six games that were developed for a Nintendo platform are not available for a Nintendo platform.
Well, not yet. I've been told by someone who works for Capcom that, you know, that it's being worked on, but I don't know. I don't even know how much this person knows. I try not to get involved in those things, like having the insider information, because it's so frequently wrong.
Yeah.
Or things change and then you wind up getting disappointed and stuff.
No, I wouldn't be shocked if it's on the way, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's how the Mega Man Legacy Collection was, wasn't it? Didn't it come out on 3DS a little later?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it's...
With the gold amiibo.
Oh, yeah. We need a gold Scrooge McDuck. Wouldn't that be perfect?
I would buy the fuck out of it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally. So, I know this has been a longer one, but for $20, what are your thoughts on this collection?
Just buy it. I mean, I can't think of anybody who couldn't get some kind of enjoyment out of this. It's like, if you hate old platformers, then okay, obviously avoid it or play Tailspin. But if you're like me and you've sat around and like thought about like, oh, I really wish I could play Chip and Dale 2. And, you know, or if you're just wanting to revisit those classics, it's like, if you like DuckTales, you like DuckTales 2. If you like both of them, you'll probably most likely like Darkwing Duck and Chip and Dale. It's like all these games are a high watermark for Capcom. So it's like, except for Tailspin, you are guaranteed to have a good time. With Tailspin, I don't know. I'm sure it has its fans.
There's got to be a couple of them out there.
There's got to be.
Oh, man. Well, anyway, Chris, thank you so much for doing this. We're going to wrap up the episode now, going to end the show, probably do some Disney-themed songs. I know it seems Ray. Like DuckTales the Moon is one of the most covered game remixes out there. So
I was going to say, don't go too Disney with it, otherwise you'll be getting that copyright claim.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But we'll play a handful of Disney-related, Disney Afternoon-related. So I don't know what I'm going to play, just some Disney-ish stuff.
Right. Sound on. Good?
So, yeah. Chris, do you have any final words to end the episode completely?
Oh, you know, follow me on Twitch, whatever. And this has been a lot of video game reviews, as I understand. We're at the end of a long gauntlet that has ended successfully, 100% successfully, with my review of the Disney Afternoon Collection.